Hi, I'm David Price, author of The Pixar Touch, The Making of a Company, and you're listening to the Pixar Podcast.
To infinity and beyond!
So, how long is this going to take?
Squirrel!
You can't rush art.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now.
What's the point of going out there? They'll only laugh at me.
Stranger, from the outside.
Greetings.
Hello there, everybody. Welcome again to another episode of the Pixar Podcast. I'm your host, Derek Clements, and this is episode number 113. ThePixarPodcast.com/113 is where you can find the show notes for this episode. Okay, well, it's great to be with you in your iPod earbuds or car speakers or whatever electronic device my voice happens to be projecting from right now. Let me ask you if you recognize this sound. Of course, this sound is from the animated short film For the Birds. It debuted to mass audiences with Monsters, Inc. back in 2001. And it was written and directed by our guest. Well, I should say written and directed and designed by our guest, Ralph Eggleston. On Inside Out, this upcoming Pixar film, Ralph Eggleston was production designer. And it was an honor to talk to him about his short film, For the Birds, and also about the particular challenge it was to crack Inside Out. He said it was the most difficult film that he's worked on so far. So I hope you enjoy this interview. I should say that since we last spoke, Inside Out debuted at the Cannes Film Festival, and it received a lot of great attention. It made me so, so excited to see the rest of the film. I've only seen the first part of it. But yeah, critics loved this thing. They're saying that it's a great return to Pixar's finest stuff. And I wanted to start today by just announcing that. The buzz for this film couldn't be any higher at this point, and I'm very excited for it to come out so I can see it many, many, many times. So to help us get even more excited about that film, I hope you enjoy this interview with production designer Ralph Eggleston. I'm actually really curious about For the Birds. So when people talk about their favorite Pixar shorts, often I hear yours, For the Birds. You won an Academy Award for it.
I did. It was great. I got it from Wolverine.
Nice.
And I was about to say, well, let's see. I got it from Wolverine. And when I left the stage, I walked into a freight elevator to go take photographs with Halle Berry and Sidney Poitier, which, nice. I mean, it was like, holy cow, right? You know?
Yeah, nice.
And then we got out of the elevator, and Halle Berry was there with Denzel Washington, so we were all just hanging out. It was very strange.
That's awesome.
It was just like, I draw cartoons, I'm just like, but it was very surreal.
What's your strongest
blur?
Sure. So. What's your strongest memory story-wise, like, what's your strongest story memory from For the Birds?
There were many, of course, sure. But there were two really. One was being up on stage and seeing John Lasseter's face. Mm. I was so nervous, but when I finally found him, I didn't know where he was sitting.
Yeah.
And I finally saw him and I calmed down. So that made me really happy. It did. It sounds like PRBS, but it's the truth.
Cool.
And it calmed me down.
Yeah.
The second part was, after winning and doing all the press stuff that you got to do, and then they walk back, I had to go to the restroom so badly. And when I came out of the restroom, I was waiting for the commercials to start so I could go back into the auditorium.
Yeah.
And as I was walking across, I looked around nervously, and some gentleman, very tall gentleman, raised his Cosmo up and toasted me, and it was Paul McCartney. So I made a beeline for him and sat and talked to him for a while. Wow. You know, he had seen For the Birds at the Venice Film Festival, okay, where it was showed.
Yeah.
And he had sent me a nice note, which I still have. So
that's awesome.
Well, that was the second Pixar short that was broadcast like in front of a feature film, right? Because Jerry's – I know that wasn't –
I don't remember. Yeah. I don't.
But it was new, though. It was a new culture.
Toy Story was only our, third film?
Yeah.
Toy Story. No, Monsters was – it was Toy Story,
Bugs Life,
Monsters, and then Toy Story 2.
No.
Right. I think Toy Story 2, then it was early.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's a blur. It was early in the idea of, and I think that was really fun for audiences to see this.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. You know, and I mean, it's like I got to work on Monsters Incorporated and For the Birds.
Yeah. Okay. Final For the Birds question. The music was done by the writers in the sky. Woody's Roundup people.
Absolutely. And actually, the soundtrack is on one of the CDs.
That's right. Which I discovered that.
I didn't know about that. Yeah. It's so weird. They were great. They were really useful. You know, it was so funny because I had a notion in my mind of Hillbilly Boogie music I wanted to use, Spade Cooley.
Yeah.
And the first version of what they did, it wasn't quite right. And they said, well, kind of what do you want? I said, I was trying to give them a little leeway without telling them exactly what to do because I'm not. But I said, Spade Cooley. And they go, oh, okay. And then the next day they came back and it was perfect. That's what's in the film.
Yeah. And they were just there here. They were just here working on Toy Story 2. And so you were.
Oh, they were actually somewhere on tour and we did it over the phone.
Oh, okay.
So
cool.
Nice. All right.
Very good.
Well, I love that film. So I wanted to ask
that. Very nice. They're in our Inside Out.
The writers in the sky?
No.
Oh, the birds.
Yeah. they actually have been, I think, in every Pixar film.
Oh, I can think of them in Cars.
Yeah.
On the little, yeah.
Okay, so you described Inside Out as the hardest film you've ever worked on.
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a little bird here.
Oh,
awesome.
Okay, yes, it was very, very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, for all kinds of reasons. The most difficult two being A, what does the mind look like?
Sure.
And B, the ever-changing shifts in the story. That Riley, anything that changes in Riley's storyline affected something in the mind and vice versa.
Sure.
So yeah, it was very difficult. And how to maintain, how to figure out in terms of color and value and the tone of the visuals of the film, how to maintain a solid through line because it was always, you know, the little puzzles, you have a picture, you're missing all but one, you have everything but one piece. It was like that, but every day it was moving around.
Interesting.
So, when did you get the final piece or when did your confidence?
You know, I never did. Okay. when did it all fall together so you knew what to do?
Yeah.
3 months before we finished.
Yeah.
It was still changing. Little things here and there maybe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was crazy.
Well, it's
a very finely tuned machine, this film. So.
That's interesting. It's interesting that you use the word machine because I think that this type of art is so fascinating because animation can literally be about anything. It's such a labor-intensive game. There's so much going on.
Yeah.
So much. It's just so. There's so much to the art, and yet Pixar is a company, and you guys are making money, and you're making movies that are going to make money, and you have a schedule and stuff, and schedules and budgets. I'm curious how those things mesh with art, you know? Because we're in a room right now; it's just filled with art
on the walls.
Well, you know, even within just within the actual production. I'm one of those people. I've worked in production. I've worked in a lot of different phases, not just design, storyboarding, designing animation, all you name it. I learned on a particular project early on, not here. It was when I first got into art direction a little bit. I was supposed to be animating, and I moved to because we had a lot of different producers on the show, and they were all kind of weird. The only way I could sell an idea is to do a little pastel. And I started doing these, and they go, yeah, like that. Suddenly, I was the art director of this movie, right? And they moved me physically from one side of the building to the other to be closer to the background painters. It's traditional animation,
sure.
Right? And the ink and paint department. We were just getting into some digital ink and paint, but it was still all old school.
Yeah.
And the woman running the ink, at the time, it was the woman who was running the ink and paint department, the checking, and all of the back end half of basically the rear half of production.
Yeah.
And in Pixar world, it would be lighting. Cool. In the traditional, old school, traditional animation, it's ink and paint.
Yeah.
If an animator got a fair amount of time to do a scene, like 2 weeks for a scene, but they took six. Mm. Their deadline could change, but the ink and paint couldn't. Oh. So when you would hear an animator complain about the sloppy ink and paint work, it wasn't because they were sloppy. It was because you spent 6 weeks instead of two, and that 2 weeks was fair.
Yeah.
You know? And so what I'm not picking at animators. Sure. I totally understand it. Sure. But what I learned from this woman that ran this department is what you want to see on the screen depends all the way to the beginning. So at that moment, it clicked. I was like, I've got to learn something about production. I have a production hat and an art hat, and it's hard to turn one off sometimes. Huh. I have both on. Sometimes I actually have been accused of thinking too much about production when I'm designing something. But I want to know, and I really try sometimes. I have to let go of production. I don't want to know how we're going to do this. Yeah. I'll let someone else figure that out. There's much smarter people who are here than I am. I want to, like, sit in a theater. I'm like, what do I want to see? Hmm. What's that moment that, you know, when this thing, and how many ever years from then, from the moment I'm painting this till it's on the screen, what do I want to see? Huh. So that's how I think about it, you know? Yeah. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it's a big topic. So you worked on Monsters, Inc. Who is Pete Docter?
Well, he's this big, tall guy from Minnesota.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Okay.
All right, next question.
He has a sweet tooth. Pete's a great guy to work with. He, you know, like I am when I paint, I'm very intuitive. I'm not trained as a painter. I fell into it, honestly, by accident. Yeah. He is just intuitive. A friend of mine once described, and I always love this because it is true, so I'm co-opting it.
Okay.
A friend of mine, and he was mainly talking about Up, but he actually was talking about all of Pete's films. And we've both known Pete a long time. He goes, and again, like I said, he's talking about Up, but it could be about any of his films. His films are all about bubbles and air and sugar and cotton candy and things that they're ethereal, feathers, and but they shouldn't work, but they do. Mm. And it's because the emotional core, really. That's it. Pete's strength, in my opinion, is character. And I like to think, whether it's true or not, I like to think, certainly I know I struggle and fight very much to do my job from the same point of view, not his point of view, mm-hmm. but from the point of view of character. Mm-hmm. Pete's primary experience up until Pixar really has been as animation, mm-hmm. as has mine. But everything we do from the design of the characters to the movement of the characters, the dialogue, mm-hmm. the lighting, the story, the plot, the writing, the storytelling, the color, the cinematography, everything has to be about selling this idea, this character moment. There's a great have you ever seen Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
No, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. So just great. I always like this little story.
Okay.
The production designer, Richard Silbert, hired Dean Tavalaris, I think it was, who ended up designing a lot of Coppola, Godfather, Apocalypse Now, to help him out on some sets. And he, you know, came in and he did this set of this bathroom, you know. And the film was about these two college professors. I'll get to the next part of their character in a moment. So Richard Silbert comes in and looks at this set, and it's beautifully done. You know, there's a sink and the bathtub and all this stuff. And Richard Silbert says, yeah, this looks really good. And he grabbed some toothpaste, put it in his mouth, swigged some water, and spit it everywhere. And then threw stuff up and smudged stuff. And poor Dean Tavalaris, I mean, I read the story. I didn't hear it.
Yeah.
He said, what are you doing? What are you? He says, they're alcoholics. You know, it's from the character's point of view, not your point of view as a designer.
Yeah.
It has to be from the character. So that's the way Pete works.
Cool.
And the character's interactions, that's the way I like to work too. And so that's why I always gravitate to like people like Pete and Brad Bird, you know.
Cool.
So that's where they come from. So
great. Okay.
Well, that's all my questions. Thank you. It was so good to meet you. Thank you.
Yeah, so nice to meet you.
You're listening to the Pixar Podcast. That was Ralph Eggleston. He's a production designer in Inside Out, and he's also the Academy Award-winning filmmaker behind For the Birds. And I'm now going to play for you his presentation that he gave to a group of journalists inside Pixar Animation Studios. He was pointing to a lot of production artwork as he was giving his presentation, and so I would encourage you to look at some of that artwork on thepixarpodcast.com. the show notes for this episode, you can find some of the images that he's kind of talking about. Color scripts and behind the scenes artwork. I hope that you'll enjoy watching that. So, without further ado, here is the presentation by Academy Award winner Ralph Eggleston.
Hi, my name is Ralph Eggleston, production designer at Pixar. I've been here since 1992. I've been lucky enough to work on a lot of the films here in various capacities, consultant and designer. Actually, I've never animated here other than selling some ideas. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's crazy. It's so weird to see the film. I've been on break for a while, so coming back and seeing all this again, it's kind of like deja vu all over again. And some flashbacks as well. So, and some of them good. This is the hardest film I ever worked on. It's the longest film I ever worked on. It's 5.5 years. Most of them take 3, 3.5, 4 years. But this one, because of the nature of it, it's such an abstract idea, it's such an intellectual notion. What is the mind? How do emotions work? You know, it's like pretty crazy. And it's deceptively simple to when you start, but then you have to visualize it as well. And then the jumping back and forth between the mind world and the real world. Originally, Riley was a much smaller component of the film, but as the story grew, we realized you will never care about Joy. Pete always wanted Joy and the emotions to be the main thrust of the story, which they are. But we went through a whole phase of Riley's story got a lot bigger, and then it shrank down. But what we had to do is you would never care about the emotions if you didn't care about Riley. So her Riley story got really, really big, but once they knew what it was, they were able to kind of cut it down and strategically place it throughout the story to make you aware of how the emotions are reacting. But any change that happened in the real world affected what we did in the mind world and vice versa. So it was the hardest film and the most churn of any film I've ever worked on. These are our characters. One of the key early on things I knew we were going to have to deal with is the fact that there's going to be a difference between the mind world and the real world. So the real world tend to be a little bit leaning a little bit more on the quote-unquote realistic side of some of our films. And then the characters themselves lent themselves to just being kind of the idea of what they are. Joy is kind of like this, and sadness is like this, and fear is more like a line. Fear isn't about being afraid. It's about being so afraid you don't move at all, because if I make a decision, it might be a bad one. You just don't know. And then disgust and anger, they're pretty obvious shapes to express the idea of those emotions. If you saw Joy, you'll notice that she kind of roils a little bit. Well, we had Albert Lozano, my character, art director, had come up with the idea of a sparkler. That just felt like Joy. For a while, it was only when she got excited, but then it would be all the time. And then we started looking at champagne bubbles and Alka-Seltzer. And we worked for 8 months with some of the technical crew to get that to work on Joy. It was never on the other characters. And it was so expensive and time-consuming, they were about to pull the plug on it. And then we showed John Lasseter, and he says, "That looks awesome. Put it on all the characters." And then you could hear bump, bump, bodies dropping in the room. But the guys came together and really were able to make it work. Once we kind of had this idea set up, we, again, with the real world and then the mind world, the real world was a lot about hard surfaces and textures, lots of textures, high key, very bright, low contrast. There are dark colors, there's not a lot of dark shadows. And not a lot of there are reflections, but not a lot. When we get to the mind world, what we wanted to deal with is a lot of high contrast, saturated colors, translucency and light transmittive elements, architectural and growth elements within the mind. A lot of that tended to be kind of hard. These are grains of sand, macro photography of grains of sand. But we looked at plastics and a lot of flowers because they have a softer quality, and we wanted to have a whole range of basically building materials for us to build the film with. So moving forward from that, we had the Minnesota world, which has a little more color, more pastel, again, high key, low contrast, darker colors in on occasion, but not a lot of dark light shadow, dark light. That doesn't make any sense. Dark shadows, sorry. And then we get to San Francisco, which is the same light qualities, but it's very desaturated. We wanted this great difference between the two. This is our French poster, which is awesome. I don't know if they're selling this in the store, but you should buy it if you do. This is a really important board. I call it the Brainbows board. These are actually slices of brain tissue that have been injected with various chemicals to react to light differently to make them glow. We didn't want this to be a physical film that is not set in the brain, it's set inside the mind, right? But we didn't want to deny ourselves the visual opportunity of using some of those elements to kind of help the audience along. And we've got to have a shorthand to the audience. Because, you know, frankly, they don't care what the film looks like. They just want to understand it, and they want to be with the characters, right? So we had to find a lot of visual shorthand. But this board was just something I found. It's called confocal microscopic photography. And at one point, we had a forest in the film, and I'm like, oh, this looks like a bunch of trees, and they can pick ideas. So we always kept this board and another board over here, I'll get to in a minute. Kind of hung, they were always hanging up around our little area, the art room area, because we just kept going back to them. And even when we had meetings with the director, they would come by and just look at it for a while. And then they wouldn't say anything, but a week later, something from this board would end up in the film, you know, or that, or, you know, whatever. So we always have a handful of keyboards that we always refer to. Once a lot of these basic ideas are kind of agreed upon, I would turn, as a production designer, my crew would take these ideas and run. We had Albert Lozano as our character designer and art director. Bert Berry as our textures and art director, and then Dan Holland as our environment art director. They would take these key ideas and start building on them for the movie. I would then jump back and do what we call a color script. I'm used to doing them a little bit more in a linear stream of consciousness fashion, but because of the nature of the story churn on this film, I tried doing that, and by the time I finished a couple of strips, the story was just changed completely, so I would have to start all over. Got exhausting, so I decided just to break it down into panels. I worked on the Riley story on its own. Then I worked on the headquarters story on its own. Then I worked on Joy and Sadness's journey. And then we would sit and move them around, and then I would adjust the color and the value to kind of support the emotion of the overall of the film. You can see that the audience just needed to know where you were. So here's San Francisco. We're back in the mind world. We're back in reality. Back in the mind world. We're back in reality. So you always knew where you were. Now, I know the film that you guys saw stopped at about 50 minutes in, but those two worlds do collide, and you'll have to see the movie to see what I mean. This is only about Act 1 and 2. And I probably ended up doing 600 paintings for this that ended up, I think we ended up using about 200. I can't believe that. But there was a lot of story churn, and so figuring out that and how it worked, and also maintaining that emotional through line so that it just didn't feel like it was kind of herky-jerky moving around all over the place. Really had to find that the simplicity of it. It was an extreme challenge. Once this is on its way and agreed on by the director, I start breaking it down into smaller scenes. So several of those strips, for example, this is kind of the introduction of Joy all the way to here. Now I take that idea and expand on it. So those handful of paintings become a whole board of these. So this was an idea I'd come up with to see Joy get born out of the ether. And I actually animated this in Photoshop, more like a detailed storyboard, an animatic, and showed Pete the idea of how you can have this happen. And then, remember in the Disney cartoons in Warner Brothers where a paintbrush would come out and paint and then the scene would appear? I always thought that was bad. I mean, as a little kid, I was like, how does that happen? You know? I wanted to do the same thing here. I was so excited, I animated it in Photoshop, showed Pete, he thought that was pretty cool, showed it to a director of photography for lighting, Kim White, and one of her key folks was Michael Sparber. And they got together at nights and on the weekends and made this happen. They actually, we took a part of the set that we already had, and they lit it, as you see it in the film, and then turned the set off. And so all you see is the light, and then everything kind of appears. I think it works great. Someone asked earlier, was there one thing in the film that you started that was as good as what you had imagined when it was done, or better? And I'm like, that right there. I just love it. So I think they did a great job, and the animation is terrific. They did such a good job. The brain, again, the brain comes back in terms of physicalness in some of the design elements within headquarters. With the hypothalamus, we've got a lot of DNA structure here, some cells. Again, we use some of this for the hypothalamus here. Again, we didn't want to say we kind of sawed open someone's head on the film, but we did want to. We didn't want to deny ourselves some of the opportunity of using that. So, and we had to deal with the islands of personality. The idea there, and it changed a lot. They were pillars at one point. It was just on a landscape at one point. There's even a painting. I think it's out there somewhere, of a hill that goes all the way down to what. Through this tangle of stuff, the idea, the concept of the mind and what it was changed. The landscape outside of headquarters changed so much on this film; it was frightening. We finally settled on the idea of these personality islands, and there were like 10 of them. Then there were 2 of them. Then there were 5 of them. 6 of them. Then 5 of them again. And the idea is, if you become interested in something like music, it would be there. But in order to make it work and get better, you had to build on it. You had to practice, you had to go to rehearsal, you had to have concerts, things like that. Now, a little kid might be interested in playing tuba for 2 weeks and then tired of that. So that island might appear, but then it would disappear as well. So that's how some of these kind of came about. And these are kind of core things. You know, we had the family island, which is a natural, of course. Honesty, the hardest one that we had to design because it kind of looks like Judge Island. Hockey, well, you know, it's got to be a short answer. Hockey, because that's what she's very, very interested in. Friendship's an obvious one. And then goofball. And even the color palettes, we tried to kind of, this one was more about the green that reminded us of Minnesota. This one has a lot of green in it. This one was hard for all kinds of reasons. I think originally this hill was kind of purple to kind of do a robe thing. Hockey was some of the colors of her team. Friendship for her was just like getting together with her little friends. And then goofball was more like a circus. What were we going
to
say?
What made you decide to make them islands?
Pete needed something to give the audience a clue as to what she was interested in, but more importantly, what she became disinterested in as her personality started shutting down. That was the story need. So, yeah.
What were some of the other personality islands that you guys
chit chat was one. I can't remember. You know, we were just talking earlier. I can't remember beyond chit chat. I really can't remember what some of the other ones were. But someone asked earlier, "Oh, how did you guys do that?" I'm like, "Well, we would sit and write." Okay, Honesty Island. Honesty. What do you think about? You know, we would write words down, and then we would just sit and doodle. Like, what? I need something for that. And then we would whittle it down, and we'd get big pieces of paper and stand it with these big, giant, thick markers, and just draw them. Because they needed to be readable from headquarters, which is, let's see, the pit of the mine, that's not what it's called, but the canyon of the mine is 10.3 miles across. So if you're in the center, it's a good 5 miles away. But you needed to be able to read all of those things. Now, when we go to one of those islands, as the characters do, in the virtual world of our set, it's a different set altogether because this is like 2 miles high, maybe, or something. You know, this is a giant. They're still big to the characters in the movie, but it's a completely different set. So. Yes?
I meant to ask this to people, but I totally forgot. Maybe you can. Is there any particular reason or strategic reason that she has no siblings?
No, I don't know. I really don't know. You know, she used to have siblings at one point. I think she had an older brother and a younger brother at one point. Yeah, the story changed a lot.
Okay.
But ultimately for us, it was that we wanted it to be about the emotions and not about the humans, you know? That story grew and shrank over time, like I was describing earlier, so.
One more quick thought on the islands. Obviously, hockey being center there. We saw in the UK trailer that the dad is that they're watching soccer rather than
football.
Hockey. Football rather than hockey. Does this, as far as for the international release for the localization that's going to happen, is all of that animation of the hockey going to be redone and recreated for?
For Canada, we did curling.
Perfect.
I'm kidding. No, we only did soccer for international, and hockey's just for North America, I think.
But as far as so there is a like island of personality island that's. Football / soccer.
You know, that's a very good question. It's the first time I thought about that. No, not for Riley, anyway.
Got it.
And we never see outside of Dad's window, anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
Ha, I gotcha. That's actually a very good question, though. That was the first time I heard that one. Yeah. So, actually, we did have at one point an idea. which we didn't do, was to try and identify or have someone, an expert, identify which soccer teams and regions of the world might end up coming to the World Cup. And then we're going to change the color of the jerseys for each one of them. We can't predict that, so forget it. Again, another one of the physical aspects that we kind of used as an idea for designing this film was the idea of your mind, your brain being folded into a small space so that you can have more of it. But the idea also, the fold allowed neurons to connect to each other more quickly because they're closer. So that became the impetus for the maze of long-term memory of the mind. This sequence is a one-off. It was always in the film in some fashion or another. It was designed from top to bottom by Albert Lozano, my character, art director. It's the only sequence I just never worried about. I'm just like, okay, I've got all this other stuff to think about. I'm gonna let him take it over, so he did. He did almost everything himself. These are kind of sketches. I did this, and Chris Sasaki did this, but if you saw the amount of artwork that was done, 99% of it was done by Albert, pulling that together. He did a terrific job, so. The other sets, key sets in the film that I know you saw some of, Imagination Land. This was difficult because each one of the little lands was so different from one another. You have a set like Headquarters, which we did 200 something designs for. You know it's gonna be in a lot of the movie, at a lot of Act One especially, so the time is well worth spending. When you get to these things, they're just as difficult as that to actually make happen, but they're in the movie for a second and a half. It's like, oh my goodness, so hard. So we waited until a lot of the story stuff settled down, until we kind of tackled most of that. There's a great thing called the Neon Boneyard near Las Vegas. If you ever get to go, you should go there. It's really cool. Go at night, too, because they plug them all in. It's where all the old signs go to die.
Really?
It's really cool. They have a lot of weddings there and things. It's really neat.
What's the name?
I'm sorry?
What's the name of this?
I think it's called Neon Boneyard. Sorry, I'll move this out of the way real quick. This is the train of thought. This I happen to know the exact number because what happened was we had done so much work on it. My art director, Dan Holland, loves trains. John Lasseter loves trains. I had heard this number so often, I thought it was a joke. I thought I'd made it up or imagined it. So I asked one of our production assistants, I remember this number. Is that true? I said it to myself so often, I thought it was a lie, or that I had made it up or something, kind of false memory syndrome. And she looked it up, and sure enough, there were 284 designs of this train done, separate individual designs. There's some great stuff. Some of it's out in the art in the hallway, you'll see. But we started out with a choo-choo train, then we had a third rail train, and then John really loved the idea of it being a electrochemical like the mind, so it would be an electric train and catenary wires. And we had done some artwork showing that. There's some interesting stuff about it. The problem is in all the shots and the story we had to tell, a lot of these wires and tracks and things got in the way of the story and the clarity of where they were trying to get to. So we came up with the idea of what if the tracks appeared in front of them and disappeared right behind. The only rule then that we had to stick to, and this was once in the film a lot more than it currently is that it could go anywhere and the tracks could appear and disappear. But wherever it came to a stop, oh, thanks a lot. is that it had to go to a train station. And then we had several of these, I'm just joking. Sorry. It was sprinkled through the mind. And again, the film we really got to focus on the character's journey. That's the fun thing. One of the fun things about designing the film that I learned from one of the great film production designers, Richard Silbert, is it's all fun and you got to do the research. If you don't do the research, they will know, the audience will know. But he goes, but if you've done your job right, no one will notice. And he goes, if they start talking about the sets, you failed. He said it's not fair, but it's true. All the audience really wants to care about is the characters and their journey. And it's hard to swallow, but I know it's true. And it's the best thing for the film. So, who am I to complain? No. But this film had so much variety in it. It was like a bunch of mini movies, so it was kind of fun. Some were more visual fun than others. One of the things that we really wanted to do was a lot of theatrical lighting. There's that terrific film, you should find it if you can. It's actually not a great movie. but it's an interesting movie. And if you find the double DVD set, the extras are better than the movie. One from the Heart, Francis Ford Coppola's musical. You should see it. It's great. 1980, it bombed. It took him 20 years to pay off. But it is really cool. Music by Tom Waits. And they do a lot of theatrical lighting like some of these set pieces. These, we've got Small World, which uses a lot of theatrical, really theatrical lighting, pushing and pulling, saturation. But also, I was a big fan of David Hockney. These are some sets from Die Frau, shot in an opera, and Flying Dutchman. They're all the same color. The only thing that's shifting is the lighting. Now, I know you guys stopped at 50 minutes into the film, but the next 50 minutes have a lot of this, you'll see. You know, it gets pretty trippy. So we had a lot of fun with that. He did an opera called Turandot, Puccini's Turandot, which is on DVD. You can get it on Amazon. We were very lucky. I had already had it on DVD, but literally as I was showing Pete, I read an article in the San Francisco Chronicle that they were reviving that production here in San Francisco. So we sent the whole crew to see it, and we're like, yes, we're doing that. So the next time you see the movie, hopefully you'll see the whole thing, and you'll see how much of that is in the film. So anyway, that is kind of a general, I am missing something, sorry. This is, oh, I can't show you that.
You can do it.
As we all try to look at it really quickly.
We won't say anything.
No. I can't see that either. It's bodies. Dream production. So, you know, a lot of folks were saying, well, why? I mean, it was so much fun to do. I'm a big Hollywood history buff and film buff. I'm really a big history film buff. But we had all these crazy ideas of how could you create dreams, and oh, it was so much fun to come up with all that stuff. The problem was there was a story to tell, and if we spent all this time explaining each one of these things without a simple visual clue, a clear clue, it's like Hockey Island and Family Island, Dream Production, the film would be 10 hours long. So we obviously couldn't do that. So this was actually the first impetus, and there was some resistance to it because, can't we do something different? And you know what? It ended up being exactly right. It's a shorthand to what we needed to say and move on. What's fun about this, especially in the context of the very next sequence that you didn't see, is the contrast between this and what you're about to see. So this is like a fake version of reality. The next sequence is a real version of fake reality.
Mind blown.
Yeah, it's pretty trippy. I'm not kidding. So it was also, as much fun as this sequence was for Al, that next sequence was mine. That was the one I wanted to do. So I got to kind of take it over and do some lighting studies for it. I really had a lot of fun with it. So that is a smidgen of what it took to kind of put some of the design work for this film together. By no means all of it. We had a terrific team of people within the art department. The art department's probably, it is the only department that has to work with every single department on the show, editing, story, technical, lighting, even post-production, and advertising and marketing the film, and toys.
Yeah, so what year, you said that you've been working here since that?
The very, very end of 1992. I started on Toy Story.
So how has your work changed? I mean, how has technology changed your work? Because I guess now you're doing more like computer-based instead of hand-based, or?
When I first got out, I've told this story a lot, but it's true. When I first got here, they put me in a room with two wonderful people, Tom Porter and Bill Reeves, and these guys are brilliant. And they explained to me how computer animation works. I had come from traditional animation and drawing and painting, you know, and after about 5 hours, my brain was just about to explode because I'd never worked with a computer before. I got out of that office. I literally walked out of a room like this, not here, but, and John Lasseter saw me. And John was John. He wasn't John, you know, then. And he saw me. He just started laughing, you know. And he saw my eyes kind of spinning. And he put his arms around me and said, you know what, those guys are brilliant. They do something you can never do. But you can do something they can't do. I can imagine what we might need, and they can actually make it happen. So that moment on, that specific moment in my entire career at Pixar, I have never worried about how it was going to be done. And the more I do this, the less I worry about it, because we've got our tools are so much better, blah, blah, and they're always changing. So the more I worry about that, the hard part is coming up with this, at least for me, is, I mean, what they do is brilliant, And then also, there's always compromise along the way. I'll go back and redesign something three or four times, not to change what I was after in terms of an idea, but to compromise with them. We can do this, but we can't do that. I'm like, oh, I can make that work. You know? The hard part is when you don't know what the idea is. So.
But you still do a lot of hand.
I do a lot of chalk and pastel and paint. On this film, it was probably 30% chalk and paint and pastel, and the rest was digital. Mm-hmm. Hopefully on the next thing I work on, it'll be, I really want to get back to this, you know, drawing and painting. There's something very much different when I'm able to kind of, it comes out of my brain, down my arm, out of my hand. Seriously,
yeah.
The physical act of doing it is different, and not better, just, but I enjoy it more. And it depends on the project, so.
Just the last follow-up, sorry. So you said 30% it was
Don't quote me on that.
No,
you know?
So I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah.
So the 70%, the rest, somebody else did that, right?
I'm talking about the work I did. 30% was chalk and pastel, and the rest was probably about digital painting.
Okay.
So
we could have like one or two quick questions.
When you were doing the San Francisco scenes, were you basing it on Noe Valley? Because I feel like I've seen that school.
I'm not going to tell you because you might go knock on their door.
We
sent the entire story crew and art crew out for a couple of days to photograph. We split it up into regions, and we got 8,000 photos. And it's kind of an amalgamation. It really does exist, a lot of these areas.
I've seen that school before, so that's why I asked.
This one?
Yeah.
This one?
The school on the right there.
Yeah, that actually does. I can't remember which one it is, but
it
does.
It's off of Castro.
Yeah, it is. No, it is. I mean, it's changed a little bit.
Yeah.
So, but this place does really exist. Right here. We made two changes. We changed the address, name, and number, and then we extended the alley because it was a dead end.
Oh, yes.
And if you can guess where it is, which I'm sure someone will.
I'll figure it out.
I'll give you a lollipop. One
so
more question.
Deal.
Yeah, I know you have.
I was gonna ask about the inspiration for the control panel in headquarters, kind of where that came from. I don't know if it's a quick question.
It's not. We did so much. We had all these control panels. We had each one of them for a while. It was like a jungle gym. I forgot what it's called. What do you call when you have the thing on your arm and you throw the ball? Like that.
Highlight.
Yeah. It was a highlight thing, and they would throw emotion. We had this other thing where the characters would express themselves like this, and the colors would kind of appear, kind of a very Fantasia-like.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of them had their own different kind of control. Angers was like a fire pit, you know. And sadness was all about water. What we wanted to end up saying is we needed to be one control panel, because you wanted the emotions to be fighting over it. And so that's kind of where we ended up. And we put a lot more thought into it than it ended up needing. A whole lot more. So. One more? Any more?
I have a question.
Yeah, she's the only one that did. So.
Okay. I don't know if you know this already, but would that be also the title for the Spanish version?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm really not. That.
It makes sense.
It could be the same. Exactly. It could be. I'm not sure. I'm really not. So. Yeah, the marketing crew from Disney, I was really involved in seeing how they put some of this. They came up with some awesome posters that were so cool, but they weren't necessarily right for selling this film. But I wish I could just print a book of all of that stuff that they did. So great. So good. So anyways,
so
great to see you guys.
Yeah,
thank you. I hope you enjoy the finished film. I hope you don't hate it.
I think people are proud of it. I can tell what people you guys are talking about.
Well, I'm certainly proud of all the work everyone did, but again, who knows if it works. Seems to so far.
Okay, Squirt here will now give you a rundown of proper exiting technique.
Mom, it's just my ball.
Don't let it happen again.
Yes, well, I'll try to be less careless.
It's got this kind of smoothy, melty, it's not really a smoky taste. It's a certain, it's kind of like a, it's kind of like this boom, zap kind of taste. Don't you think? What would you call that flavor?
Lightning?
Don't look at the light!
I can't help it. It's so beautiful.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you.
Gone! It's all gone. All of it's gone. Bye-bye. Woo, see ya.
Thank you for listening to the Pixar Podcast.